Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine, and that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Today I am talking to Caitlin Canty and Noam Pokilny. We've talked to Noam before on this show. He's the insanely talented, can I say he's the most talented banjo player alive today? I think I can safely say that. He's the banjo player in the Punch Brothers with Chris Thiele, and Caitlin Canty is a great singer-songwriter now based in Nashville. I was able to check out her record since we did this interview. It's awesome. And Noam actually produced it. The two did a little mini West Coast tour that included a stop that was mere blocks away from the Fretboard Journal. So I'm glad they stopped by. We have a video of them that will be coming up on fretboardjournal.com very soon. And while producing an album is no small feat, and Noam certainly has the ears to do it and do it justice, and he did a fantastic job. Probably the coolest thing I saw when I saw them play in concert last night was Noam played an entire show backing up a guitar-based singer-songwriter with his National Tricone plectrum, and it was ridiculously good. And it's just another testament to how talented this guy is. Even with just four strings, he sounded like everything from David Rawlings to Jerry Douglas to, I don't know, insert your favorite backing guitarist here. It was truly a great night of music, and definitely check out her album. It's coming out on Friday, March 30th. Before we get to that, today's podcast is sponsored once again by Lane over at Dying Breed Music. If you don't know about Dying Breed Music, they keep getting amazing flat-top guitars from the golden era, and right now they have a bunch. They have a 1934 Gibson Roy Smek Stage Deluxe. He's got that 1940 Recording King Ray Whitley. That was, of course, also built by Gibson, and a lot more. He's got Martins galore, including a 1942 D18 and a 1944 0017. You can email Lane or you can call him at 870-818-3434. He's all about the same-day response. He's a great guy to walk you through the entire buying process as well as his consignment process. So if you want to reach out to him, his whole inventory can be checked out at dyingbreedguitars.com. I am recording this on the morning of March 23rd, and I will soon be headed to Texas because on Tuesday, March 27th, we are throwing our big Austin Fretboard Journal meetup. This is the first time we've done anything quite like this. All the details can be found on fretboardjournal.com, or you can just email us and I'll email you the info. The party starts at 6 p.m. and it goes until 10 p.m. We have a $10 suggested donation for a local Austin charity for musicians. And here's what I know. It's at the new Calton Case Factory in Austin, which alone, if we did nothing else, we're just threw a party at Calton, that would be pretty damn cool. But we're also going to have music by Red Volkert, Paul Glass, Anthony DaCosta, who has helped us out a ton organizing this whole thing, and singer-songwriter Raina Rose. We're going to have some readings from the magazine. I'll say something. Our pal River Horse is going to read from some of his contributions to the magazine, maybe a few others. We're going to have some live interviews. I know Steve McCreary from Callings will be there. And I'm going to break some news to everybody right now that I'm very excited about. I'm not going to post this on Facebook or on our website, but we just got confirmed that Dave Alvin and Jimmy Dale Gilmore are going to be there, and we're going to be interviewing them as well. So it's going to be a fun night. We're going to be giving away a bunch of cool stuff, including a new Waterloo WL-14, I believe, and a Calton case and a bunch of other goodies. We hope to see as many of our greater Texas area readers there. It's going to be a lot of fun, and that's, again, March 27th. Back here in Seattle, we are hard at work buttoning up issue 42 for the printer. It looks fantastic, but we obviously still have copies of the pretty much brand new Fretboard Journal 41, which has David Rawlings, Jason Isbell, Michael Chapdelaine, Red Diamond Mandolins, and a whole lot more. If you want to subscribe to the magazine, I say this every week, go to fretboardjournal.com, use the coupon code podcast, and you will save $5 off of your order, and we will thank you tremendously. We are a reader-supported magazine, so all of the support you give us through the print magazine, it's what keeps the lights on here for all this free content we give you every week. All right, here is my conversation with Caitlin Canty. Her new record is called Motel Bouquet, and once again, it's out March 30th, and if you have enjoyed our podcast and you like what we're all about, you should definitely check out her record, because I highly recommend it.
So this is a rarity. Usually at the Fretboard Journal, we talk to artists like 6 months after their records come out. But this is actually timely. You have a record out next week.
Next week. I can't wait.
And Noam Pikilny produced it.
That's right.
Yes, he did.
So how do you guys know each other?
I moved to Nashville 3 years ago.
Okay.
And that's how I got to know Noam. But we actually ran into each other first at outside of Rockwood Music Hall, mm-hmm. In New York City, where there's a couple stages at that venue. And I was playing one stage and he was playing the other. And he was friends with my band. So that's the original meeting.
Yeah, so we were both part of the New York music scene, like surrounding Rockwood and that whole kind of scene for several years. But when we both kind of relocated to Nashville around the same time in 2014, I left New York.
I was 2015.
2015? Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I moved to LA briefly, signed a year lease, and lasted 7 months.
Really?
And moved to Nashville. He doesn't like the sun.
And, moved to Seattle.
Yeah, I should have. Yeah, no, I remember when I was living in LA, we did a photo shoot. We flew up and did a photo shoot in Portland, and it was pouring all day. I'm like, this should have been my city. I should have moved to the Northwest. So yeah, I moved to Nashville quickly after that, and Caitlin moved to town a year in the next year. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of mutual friends, and Gary Pechoza, Aoife O'Donovan, Critter kind of got us connected. And
Yeah.
And then talk to me about this record. I haven't heard it. I've only heard what you played here a few minutes ago. What was sort of the thought behind it, and why'd you pinpoint this guy to produce it?
Well, we had co-written two songs on the record. Noam's pretty... I think we had played a few shows together at that point. So he was one of the only people I'd met who understood the songs. And every time, anyone who gets to play with Noam is lucky, but these were brand new songs. Mm-hmm. So to have somebody who's bringing their own ideas to your, the little skeletons of your new songs was such a great time to meet someone with great ideas. And, I saw Noam play with Stuart Duncan, your duo, at the Station Inn, one of the first nights I was in town. And, I think we have a lot of the same tastes. And so when we went into the studio, it was actually for one day to get one song. Noam had put together a band of great musicians locally, and some people I'd played with before, some people had played in bands or in sessions, for years, kind of like a bunch of brothers and a bunch of strangers. Mm-hmm. And we went in to get one song, we got four. And it felt so good. We booked two more days, and that was the record right there.
Right. It was kind of... that's one of the beautiful things about Nashville, of like putting together a session like that. There's so many studios and like so many musician friends around that it felt kind of informal.
Yeah.
In the sense that you just wanted to get a song or two, and we kind of put this band together of kind of friends and colleagues and recorded it... one of Caitlin's friends' studios, Josh Grange. And
okay.
So we went in, and it was just kind of a really joyous and productive session. So we decided to book two more days and get a whole record out of it.
That's awesome.
So it was just a three-day session where everybody was playing live, and Caitlin sang all the vocals live. There's not a single vocal overdub on the record, which I really kind of enjoy the live nature of this. And so we would kind of... We just tracked each song for about an hour, and then we chose our favorite take, and sometimes would put together an edit of a couple of our favorite takes. And so it just kind of felt very organic. And it was your first experience recording in Nashville, your own project. It was my first time producing, I think people have different conceptions of what producing actually entails. Like, some producers are incredibly hands-on, where they're kind of crafting a record like note by note, beat by beat. And the most successful projects I've been around where there have been producers in play have been producers who are really kind of hands-off. And I think what the people I've been around who are best at producing are really great at enabling people to just kind of play their best, enabling people to really shine and to stay out of their heads. And with the group of people that we assembled, I think the best way for me to enable people was to just let everyone do their own thing and just to not intervene. It was really just a session of people who were kind of, who knew each other pretty intimately musically, except for the fact that Stuart Duncan and Paul Coert had never played on a session or on stage before. So that was kind of a cool moment to capture the first time that they had ever had a musical encounter. But most of the other guys had played, you know, several sessions.
And you played electric guitar on it, so you weren't just listening to takes and saying, hey, that felt good. You were in the band.
Yeah, I was playing. So. I was playing the band. And it's funny, you know, like I had never really played anything other than banjo except for like a couple tracks on my solo album. And so getting to be the electric guitar player in that band, it was really liberating to like hear this sound that I was contributing that wasn't familiar and like identifiable as kind of like my banjo sound. It's almost like wearing like a disguise to a party. Like you show up at a party and nobody knows it's you, so you could say whatever the hell you want. Yeah. Like just test things out. So there's an element of that in the recording.
And I like to record live. I think I've tried a lot of different ways, and I don't like to have rules. This is my way or the highway. You know, no click track, must be live. But those are my rules. Anytime I've strayed from them, I don't enjoy it. I don't end up ever releasing the thing that happened. You know, some people have made great records stacking up everything from bass to drums and then overdubbing vocals a month later. And
yeah,
I don't do well with that. I'm a live musician. I tour. I would rather be in the room with the people making the music. And if the magic's there, then it ends up on the record. You don't have to try to concoct it later. I lose my mind if I would try doing that later.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me, like most records of roots music that I love were recorded before even the technology existed to kind of build a record up from the ground up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think there's this disconnect between the intent of quote unquote roots music and like the way it's been kind of classically, I mean like classical music, but like historically recorded over the years. Now that we have all these tools of isolation and overdubbing and pitch shifting and all this stuff, it's like there's such a allure of all the like the studio gizmos and gadgets, and it's like, well, if this is, we're paying for a studio and they have all this stuff, like let's use all of that. Whereas like I think it usually leads to like a real sterilization of the the project. I mean, there are records, like if you take, you know, like a Radiohead record, which is filled with soundscapes and layering and electronic music, that like you need all of these tools that exist in a modern day studio to make a record that has a canvas like that. But for folk music or roots music, I almost think that ability to clean things up and perfect things endlessly is really the third rail. And so,
but it also means you have to play with people who can turn on a dime.
Yeah.
And that's what, I mean, I used to play soccer when I was a kid, and everyone always says, play up. If you want to get better, play up. So I have this band of musicians who are just lights out, incredible people who can, you know, bring their ideas, but also turn on a dime in a song they've barely played before.
Yeah.
And that's like, that made it so exciting for me to hear these songs, and we would, you know, build them together in the room.
So who else was on the record?
Well, we had Jerry Rowe was playing drums, Paul Coert was playing bass, and then Russ Paul was playing pedal steel, and Stuart Duncan played fiddle. And then the only overdubs on the record were when Noam was on tour with Aoife O'Donovan and Gabe Witcher. She overdubbed her vocals, and Gabe added some fiddle on two songs, which felt like such a nice thing for them to do on their day off.
Yeah. Now, Nashville's not that big a town, but were you meeting any of these musicians for the first time, or you knew them all?
I knew them all, actually, but I hadn't played with them all.
Yeah.
I'd only played with Paul and Noam and Josh, who was engineering.
Josh Grange.
Josh Grange, yeah. And I hadn't played with Russ or Stuart. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was the first time. But I think, yeah, you'd seen a lot of the people playing around town, and then, like, you were at Telluride around a lot of these people. So it kind of felt kind of very neighborly.
You did.
That's kind of a nice thing about recording locally, is it doesn't feel like it's necessarily this huge to-do.
Nobody flew in for it.
Yeah. I think that it's like the heightened recording experience can sometimes be debilitating, and mm-hmm. so it's nice to just be able to kind of drive down the block and
totally
and record some tunes. Yeah.
So besides the sort of relaxed vibe of it, were there pinpoint records where you're like, I want to have the sound of this record, or were there eras or anything that were you thinking about as an influence? Or
I think we worked, we thought more about who's in the room. Mm-hmm. And we had, I think we had 12 songs. We end up with 10 on the record, you know, try to try different approaches with those songs. Some, you know, hang well better together, and that became the record. We didn't, I've done that in the past where I've, you know, had my, like, my new, a new producer and a conversation you want to have, and it's easier to say what you're talking about when you say blues, if you can point to that one record, or if you can say this Otis Redding record, or, you know, and then you start to have a shared vocabulary.
Yeah.
I think our approach is more not the records, but the people. Like, who would kill this song?
Like a dinner party. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was the sense of, like, we're here for a day, like, we're going to try to track these three songs, or let's see what we can get. And so let's have a pedal steel, and we'll have a rhythm section of pedal steel. I'll play some electric guitar, and then we'll see what happens in the room. And so a lot of the songs kind of went through all these permutations mm-hmm. of just experimenting with keys and tempos. And, you know, the beauty of those people who played on the record, like, there were no shortage of ideas in the room. And so just, like, from the way that Russ Paul may have been playing a song like Time Rolls By, just as we were warming up, like, that, I think it started to come into the focus just as everybody was kind of sitting down at their instruments. And so it was really kind of, I like that dinner party. Mm-hmm. Like, there was no agenda other than trying to, I think, kind of capture the live aspect of Caitlin's vocals. I think aesthetically,
it was falling into what I usually do. Also, I'm, you know, often tour with Eric Haywood, who doesn't live in Nashville, mm-hmm. and would have been at that dinner table. He plays pedal steel and electric guitar with me usually on tour, and pedal steel was definitely going to be part of this record. It just felt like what I do when I'm on the road, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that was another piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, and, you know, the next time we went in to do it, Russ Paul had to beg off of
one day
because he was going on tour with Dan Auerbach. And so we thought, well, it'd be fun to have fiddle on, you know, a couple songs. We'll have Stuart come in, and I hope, you know, we'll have fiddle as the alternate texture from the steel. Yeah. And I think we got 4 songs done mm-hmm. that day. So what was supposed to be just kind of a fill-in became like a huge part of the fabric of the record, of what Stuart brought to the
table. And another huge part of the record, I think, I mean, being a singer first and foremost and songwriter, Aoife is one of my favorite singers and songwriters, Aoife O'Donovan.
Yeah.
And her vocals, I usually sing with men. It's just, there's more of a contrast. I have a lower voice. I like how the harmonies sit. But singing with her, it's a really different texture. Someone says our voices dovetailed well together. I thought that was kind of nice. But it made it feel right and also different from anything I'd done prior.
So this record comes out March 30th.
Yes.
And are there plans to actually get the whole gang together in a live setting?
We have a show at the Station Inn.
Oh, you do?
An album release show. Whether we're able to get everybody remains to be seen.
Yeah.
It seemed like a miracle just scheduling the 3 days for the recording. But we'll have at least 3 or 4 of us there.
Yeah.
Caitlin will be there. So hopefully... Hopefully that'll we'll be able
hail
to recreate
going on.
It.
Wow,
that's hail.
Yeah,
that's just applause. That's applause from the rest of the people in the building standing out of the side of the door. We really love the candor.
Wow.
kidding.
It's so sunny.
How often does that happen? You have to put some snow chains on to get to your gig.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen too often. No.
Uh-huh. Amazing.
So, Caitlin, you have some pretty cool guitars.
Thank you.
Where did they come from? Tell us about them.
Well, you saw my Recording King guitar. That's my number one. I got that guitar in Boston, gosh, maybe 6 years ago now.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, and it's a 1939 Regal made that guitar. It was a Montgomery Ward, mail order guitar. And I just love it. I think at the time, I was looking for a new guitar. I use a lot of capos when I'm writing and singing. And anyway, just to change keys once I like the pattern I'm doing. And that guitar, I was told, I remember Hans Holzen was one of my guitar players, and he said, you know, you should probably get a brand new guitar. It'll be more friendly, a little less cranky. And but of course, I walked in and there's this beautiful guitar. I started playing everything in the store.
Where was it?
It was at the Music Emporium in Boston.
You know,
and
that place.
I hate playing guitar in music stores. I hate it. Everyone's also playing at the same time. And it didn't matter. I was in a bubble with this guitar and I couldn't leave it behind. So I don't usually have that kind of connection with an instrument, but it's really funky too. It's got a really thick neck and a V-neck, and it kind of seems like it has a smaller sound hole, just barely, than, you know, it has a, it's a sound that fits with my voice better than like the J45s all my friends have that I love playing, have that same kind of, I don't know, dusty sound, but mine has a little more, I don't know, nasally punch.
It's pretty dry, but you also play, like, your picking style is quite a bit different.
I like flesh and
like
nail.
Kind of hybrid finger picking, and then like you're using your nail when you're strumming, and so it's like it's activating the top in a different way.
Yeah. I love it, and I've said it maybe once or twice before, but when I got that guitar too, it smelled like cigars. Like, it felt like an old cranky man, and I loved
that's Stu Cohen, the owner of the Music Emporium. No, just kidding.
He'd been sitting there for 2 years.
Oh, really?
All the guys in Boston, all my guitar friend players knew about it, would go visit it and play it, but it was a little too funky for their tastes.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had probably a better, more expensive guitar that functioned the same way, but that one was my guitar, just waiting for me.
Well, you're touring with it. It must have kept some, it must be staying stable and playable.
Yeah, I love it. It's great. I carry it on everywhere I go.
And then with the other guitar?
Kalamazoo.
Yeah.
And that one is actually Noam's guitar that we're touring with. But I have written 2 songs for this record on it.
Yeah, but you have one. That guitar, I bought that because I played your Kalamazoo that I thought was really cool. And so I wanted to find one. And so that's a
1932?
I'm not sure. I think it might be late 30s as well. It's a KG-11, which those Kalamazoos are great instruments.
Yeah.
And it's funny that, both of your...
And I like to keep that one tuned down, so a full step.
Yeah.
And just let it live there. And that way, you know, I've got my guitar. I can't strum that KG-11. It just is, you know, those strings are too sloppy. But it gets those low... beautiful tones, and so a lot of the songs I've written on there are the, you know, one you heard, the sadder, you said, uh-oh, sad song's coming up.
Yeah.
Because you heard the first chord. But it's really, it's just got a different personality once I loosen those strings up.
Is it down a whole step?
It's a whole step, yeah. Yeah, so.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still keeping the resale value of the National Tricone Plectrum alive?
Oh, yeah, I'm still, yeah. Still keeping that large segment of the American economy rolling there.
At any guitar show where someone's trying to flip one of those, somebody can always say, well, Noam Pikilny's been playing one.
Yeah, that's right. And they're like, who?
Yeah, maybe.
You know, I when I first started playing one of those things, I thought, oh, man, this is just, it's just a matter of time before you see one of these on every corner. And I think it's this beautiful combination of being like incredibly cool sounding and rare and fairly inexpensive compared to the rest of
the national
six string guitars are really valuable and expensive, and this is the national that time has forgot, and it's been awesome for me.
Yeah,
I really love playing that thing.
When you said you played electric on the record, was that your telly? Or?
That was my telly. Yeah.
How's that doing for you?
It's doing pretty good. I really do enjoy loving that. I enjoy loving that guitar. I enjoy playing that thing, and that was my first time playing it with on a recording with a full band. I had used it on a solo track on my record, but yeah. I had never really tried to make it work with the band. Well, I never played electric guitar. I was wholly unqualified for that.
I just rolled my eyes, but it wasn't audible, so I wanted to make sure I noted that.
And
for
folks hearing this and not knowing, this isn't like a Fender Squire Classic vibe. This is a...
Oh, it's a 53 Tele. Yeah, it's just a humble 53 Tele that I really enjoy playing. And I think I did most of the record on the... in the middle position, which is not necessarily what most people go for the bulk of a project, but I think there may have only been one song that was bridge position, but that 53 Tele I have really sounds good in the middle position. But I think
electric banjo.
Oh yeah, I played electric banjo. That's another instrument that has only seen the light of day on this project.
A Gibson Charlie Christian one?
Yeah, it's an original 5-string Gibson Charlie Christian banjo from 1941. They made two
of
them. And the one that I have was found in South Africa. Jim Mills found it in South Africa. And it has an original 5-string neck, like a 5-string Mastertone banjo from that era. It's a top tension neck glued onto this, hollow body, solid top, electric banjo with a vibrato tailpiece on it. It's a pretty wild instrument. I used that on Caitlin's song Leaping Out. It almost sounds kind of like a Wurlitzer on it. But I played that and the...
And you played the tricone on a couple.
And the national, the tricone, and the telly. Sorry, the national, the telly, and the electric banjo.
Now, the Charlie Christian pickups can be temperamental for guitarists. How does... Yeah. Is this thing actually usable in a studio?
Yeah, I think whatever direction I was pointing at wasn't picking up too much hum, but I have I did break that thing out at a different studio for my solo project and had to put it away because the hum was crazy, and it was I don't know where it was getting all this interference from, but it also it's like there I'm not sure they really figured out how to ground those things you're only grounded. If I ended up running a ground wire, of course this is reversible for whoever's going to contact me trying to buy it. I ran a ground wire to the vibrato tailpiece so that the thing wouldn't buzz while I was playing it. That seemed to help it.
That's electric banjo for sale at gmail.com, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's incredibly rare. One of a kind. One of two electric banjo for sale at gmail.com. No, that's one that... That will never go away. I love that thing.
Do you use the same amp that you used through your Tele?
For this record, I was just using a deluxe reverb that was at Josh's. But, I have this EH-185 amp, which is the piggyback Charlie Christian amp that I got because it matched the case from that electric banjo. But the Tele sounds really good through that. That's what I used on my own record, was the Tele into that EH-185. But I do feel like that electric banjo sounds best through that amp from that era. It's a pretty dark amp comparatively, and those pickups are so screaming that it kind of tempers the output of the instrument plugging into that Gibson Tweed amp.
Got it. Yep. I know you guys got to run to your sound check, but what's next for you, Noam?
We're working on a Punch Brothers record right now, trying to get it done by summertime because we're going out on tour in July and August and September. So we're getting close.
All right.
Yeah.
A lot of electric banjo on it?
Oh, it's everybody. It's just an electric banjo orchestra.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll just do a pass with the electric banjo and then Thiele will come in and he'll overdub another electric banjo on there. It's going to be our biggest record yet.
I love it.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.